As I got another rhyme, another rhythm for y'all to listen. I'm never quitting on my mission. I'ma roll with what I'm giving. Got some ambition, this new addition, filling positions. Looking at the void in myself and feeling what's missing. Better watch the way you're going, better go in the right direction. In the moment you stressing, but you gon' be counting blessings. And I know that for certain, keep on working, open curtains. Haters swerving, cause they ain't ready for your final version. Whoa. I'm never gon' give up, fall down, I just gotta get up, yeah. Cause this is my road.
You're listening to the Tom Ficklin Show on WNHHLP 103.5 FM, your home for community radio.
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Harry. That melodious voice you heard is our station manager, and I say this every show not to be redundant, but just to kind of emphasize the fact that teamwork is dream work, that we can only get something done with collaboration and cooperation and sincere feelings, warm feelings for one another. So I told Harry just before we went on air that I loved him, and it's fascinating that people will say, well, a guy should not tell. Well, guys don't normally say that to other guys. But I think the emotions are really important these days, particularly as we enter the holiday season. So I just want to kind of share the love for Harry, as well as for the universe, for that matter. And also for my guests. Also for my guests today, we have Dr. Sylvia Nzuki. Dr. Sylvia Nzuki is the professor of medicine at the Yale University School of Medicine. Reverend Clayton cannot be with us because of, you might have seen his name mentioned, but because of his pastoral duties. We have Reverend Eldon Morrison is with us, pastor of Shaw Temple AME Zion Church in Spearma, Georgia, and he's a cultural ambassador to the Yale Clinical Research Program. Some of you may recognize the name Reverend Eldon Morrison. He was graced us here in New Haven for a number of years. Reverend Morrison, how long were you pastoring here at Varick?
It's about 10 years almost.
Almost a decade.
Yeah.
He still is very much with us. And Reverend Leroy Odinga Perry is with us from St. Stephen's AME Zion Church in Brantford, Connecticut, which is just outside of New Haven. I mentioned the locations, not to say that it's very important, but we're a universal kind of show. People will hear this information that we're about to bestow worldwide, and it's just so important. But if you're in the Georgia area near Spearma, Reverend Morrison, locate Spearma for us. Is it how far is it from Atlanta, or what city is it near?
It is in the Atlanta metro area. It is right outside of Atlanta. In fact, it is the home of the Braves Stadium right here. So okay. We're just about 10, 15 minutes from the city.
And it dawned on me that I've decimated the name. It's Spima, correct?
Smyrna.
Spearma. Okay, my mind Smyrna. Makes me. And Brantford is just outside of New Haven. And Dr. Nzuki, where's home for you?
Well, right now I live in Stratford, Connecticut, just down the road from New Haven, but I'm born and raised in the Bronx, New York.
All right, so East Coast person. And we're going to talk about diabetes in the African-American community. That might sound like a redundant theme. You might have heard the word diabetes. Certainly, if you haven't heard the word, or you know that it's impacted someone in your life, your family, your networking. But I'm just convinced Dr. Nzuki, as well as Reverend Morrison and Odinga, that this issue, we just can't talk about this enough, but we can also act on this enough. So this show is about acting on how do we kind of limit or decrease or just, if not prevent, just diminish to some degree, really the nefarious impact of diabetes on our community. I might go into some stats later, but Dr. Sylvia will certainly share those. But let's talk about this condition, Dr. Nzuki. Can you tell us what diabetes is? People have these folklore terms. But let's get down to the actual medical definition.
So it's pretty simple. It means that your blood sugar, the amount of sugar in your bloodstream, what we call in medicine glucose, is too high. Normal glucose should be in the 80s, 90s, maybe low 100s. But once it gets over 126, it's an odd threshold, but there's a reason for that, related to the WHO criteria. But it's 126 or higher. Once you achieve that rate, that level, fasting, then you're felt to have diabetes.
And the folks share with me some of the statistics and the demographics and the numbers, and it still just continues to astound me that Is it true that approximately 88 million American adults, I mean, like one in three, have prediabetes?
Prediabetes. So those numbers I said before, 126 being the threshold, the glucose level that makes you have diabetes, there is often years of prediabetes, and that would be a fasting glucose somewhere between 100 and 125. So when we wake up in the morning, ideally, we should have a blood sugar under 100. It's a little lower in women than in men, but under 100 is what's considered absolutely normal. 100 to 125 is this phase we call prediabetes, and then 126 is where you have diabetes, usually type 2 diabetes. And I think the important message is that you don't go from normal to diabetes, you know, on Tuesday. It's a long process. It takes years, if not decades. And we know from clinical studies done here in the U.S., which included lots of people from minority communities, that good diet and good exercise and just keeping moving can have an enormous impact on reducing the rates of progression. In other words, you can eliminate the individuals who progress from prediabetes to diabetes with healthy lifestyle.
But there are a bunch of googobs, a tremendous amount of folks that are on the on-ramp to potentially getting diabetes unless.
Yeah. Last time the CDC reported this, which a couple of years ago I recall, was 34 million Americans have type 2 diabetes. And I believe the amount of prediabetes, my recollection is 82 million, but irrespective of the number, it's a lot of people. Not everyone with prediabetes will develop diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the number I keep in mind is it's about 5 to 10% per year of the diabetes. You can think of it as a lake that feeds the stream of diabetes. The people mm-hmm. who get diabetes come from that lake of individuals with prediabetes, but not everyone who has prediabetes we'll get into that stream of type 2 diabetes.
And we're going to talk about the various types, and I'm glad you referenced the phrase clinical trials. We'll certainly talk about that as well. I just want to stick with the prediabetes for a second, because folks, and you alluded to it a little bit in terms of mobility, but what is there a treatment or is it reversible or what? I just want to hone on to that point for a second to prevent people from graduating.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so there's no approved treatment in terms of medication. I actually don't consider it a disease. I may be in the minority in the medical community. I don't like to think of prediabetes as a disease. You know, there is this over-medicalization in the U.S. I think of it as a risk factor. Diabetes is the disease. Prediabetes, I think of as a major risk factor. And the progression to type 2 diabetes can be decreased through healthy lifestyle. So that we know, it's a 60%. Mm. It's a huge, we rarely see numbers that large in medicine, 60% risk reduction by healthy lifestyle. And those are, you know, just very doable things like losing 7% of your body weight, because most people with prediabetes and diabetes type 2 we're talking about are overweight, if not obese. So 7% reduction in body weight, which is not a crazy goal, right? If you're about 200 pounds, it's losing 14 pounds. It's doable. It's not like we're saying you got to lose 50 pounds. So 7% body weight loss. Being active, so doing exercise during the course of the day, about 150 minutes per week, which is like a half hour. 5 days a week, you know, if you find something that is 15 minutes away from your home, you walk there and you got to get back, right? So that's 30 minutes. These are simple messages. And also eating healthy, you know, reducing concentrated sweets and high-fat diet. Those three elements will prevent type 2 diabetes 60%, which is an impressive number, but it's even more impressive when you look at studies that say, okay, these were individuals with prediabetes that were recommended these interventions, right? Diet, exercise, eating healthy, losing weight. If you actually look at the people who were successful in achieving those the goals, those who did lose 7%, those who did exercise 150 minutes per week, those that did eat healthy, the risk reduction from progression of prediabetes to diabetes was more than 90%. You know, more than 90% to me is like you've frozen the metabolism in prediabetes. Some actually revert back to normal, not even prediabetes, normal glucose tolerance. But you can actually absolutely prevent the development of diabetes if you are successful in achieving those lifestyle goals. I think those are important messages.
Going with the holiday season and the climate up here in the Northeast, and so getting out is just something to really be aware of. Reverend Perrin, Reverend Morrison, let me kind of bring you in for a second in terms of, before we go to type 1, type 2, and research, et cetera, but I want to stick on the pre-diabetes just for a second, because this prevention, this early intervention, if you will, lifestyle kind of change, I think it's really important to hone on. You guys have a congregation, you work with people, you see people, you're in the milieu, so to speak. Health checkups and encouraging people to kind of be involved and taking charge of their life. What are some of your thoughts about how the church kind of gets involved with that in terms of promoting and I wouldn't say baptizing or anointing, but just inculcating within your body politic the need for these preventive steps? Reverend Perry, would you like to go first?
Yes, Tom. I think that the awareness is so important right now for us and the Black community in particular. And, you know, if you don't get regular checkups, you don't have access to a primary care physician, and the only time you see a doctor is in the emergency room, you know, it's very unlikely that you will be diagnosed for anything other than what you go to the emergency room for. I would say, too, that as growing up in a society without an iPhone and iTablet, we spend most of our time at the park playing basketball, running, and outside. And you didn't see the kind of obesity that we see now in our community. So, I mean, and even in the school, it was required that you had physical education. I'm not sure. I think we have to go back to looking at all the segments of our community and seeing how we can put together a package to help with prevention and management of prediabetes and diabetes. So it has to start in the home. What do you eat? Fast food restaurants and all that. It has to be a mindset, as well as in the school and in the church and in our communities. We have to work together to put together a plan and bring out the awareness of how diabetes can be managed and maybe even prevented. That's one thing we haven't done because we're working on so many different fronts. Like when you're just trying to live from day to day and, you know, you're going from program to program, it's very hard to focus on your health. So what YCCI has done is that we have this program called Help Us Discover. And so your program and our newsletter and with our church bulletins and announcements, community partners, I think we can make a dent in this. And I'm so glad that we're able to be on your show today to draw attention to it. And I want to thank you, Dr. Nsukye, for being here with us today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Reverend Morrison, please share this. And get promise not to pass the collection plate until after the...
I'll promise not to do that. I think Dr. Perry, really just hit on to so many things. And I would, while he was talking, I was actually thinking about how the cultural ambassadors started with YCCI. And diabetes was one of the first things that we talked about, cancer and diabetes, because it is ravishing our community so badly. And you know, it seems like with every generation, it's getting worse. And part of that is what Dr. Perry said, is that a couple of generations ago, you were more active. You know, my grandparents talked about how they walked everywhere in their community. Right now, we're, you know, we drive everywhere, or we are at home because of a pandemic. So everything is delivered to us rather than going somewhere, walking, getting out, fresh air, all those kind of things. We just don't do it anymore. And so our communities are suffering. Our kids are in front of computer screens for school, and then TV screens with the games and things all day long. And so encouraging our people is something that has become a part of the church, I think, to become active again, to get out and to go to the park, to walk, to lead healthy lifestyles. I think in the church, it's become maybe a tag word. It's been holistic. So not just religion, but how's your physical health? How is your mental health along with your spirituality? And we've had to be intentional about fusing these things together. So it seems like the more we preach it, the more we talk about it, it seems like it's not getting better. So the partnership with Yale, the partnership with Yale Medical School, YCCI, all of, and even what you're doing now, Tom, is so very important because our people need to hear it in multiple ways.
Well said. Dr. Inzuki, let's jump to have these people hear these words, type 1, type 2, and they may not be as familiar with gestational diabetes, but what's the difference between these forms of type 1, type 2, and gestational diabetes? What's the delineation there?
So it used to be pretty simple, but it's gotten a little bit more complex recently, and I'll try to explain why. It used to be that if you were a kid and got diabetes, you had type 1 diabetes. And typically these were thin, lean, previously healthy children, sometimes teens, sometimes young adults. But the feature was that they were young in life, they were not overweight or obese, and the diabetes was severe. In other words, their blood sugar went up to 600 when they were diagnosed. That's type 1 diabetes. That is a immune destruction of the pancreas. The pancreas is the organ that produces insulin. And when you attack the parts of the pancreas that make insulin through the immune system, you can't utilize glucose and you need insulin injections. There's only one treatment for type 1 diabetes. Unfortunately, it's insulin injections and several times per day or use of an insulin pump. So that's type 1 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, older individuals, typically over age 45 to 50, often people in their 50s and 60s. And typically, these individuals are overweight or, frankly, obese. And the physiology, in other words, the biology of the diabetes is completely different. It's almost two different diseases. The insulin is still being produced in people with type 2 diabetes. It's just that insulin doesn't work well. So we use the term insulin resistance. I mean, lots of the research that was done on insulin resistance in the 1980s and 1990s was actually here at Yale, where we determined exactly how insulin resistance developed and how obesity led to insulin resistance and how insulin resistance led to diabetes. But it's a, you know, I like the analogy of hearing when I talk to patients about insulin resistance, because if you have a friend or a family member who's hard of hearing, you can communicate with that individual. You just have to raise your voice, right? You have to shout a little bit. Well, that's what happens to the body. The body needs insulin to get glucose levels into the cells where they can be burned. It can be burned for energy and out of the bloodstream where it does damage. And the cells of the body that absorb glucose are a little hard of hearing to the insulin signal. They can't hear the signal very well. So the pancreas shouts, it makes more and more insulin to cram the glucose into these cells, because the pancreas really wants to keep the blood sugar down to normal, wants to avoid diabetes. And you can imagine that the analogy we also use when we talk about the development of this insulin resistance leading to high insulin levels, that over time, to continue the analogy, the pancreas gets a little hoarse. It gets tired of shouting all that insulin. And therefore, it starts to decrease its insulin production. It poops out. It can't make that much insulin over many, many years. And now you have a disconnect. You have the body that needs more insulin because of insulin resistance, hard of hearing, like I said before, and the pancreas that can no longer shout that much insulin to the rest of the body. And that leads to the glucose creeping up initially from over 100 into the pre-diabetes category. And then once it hits 126 into the type 2 diabetes category. So that's pretty simple, right? Young, skinny, type 1, severe diabetes, it happens right away. It happens suddenly. Type 2, older, overweight, or obese, not so much insulin deficiency, but more insulin resistance, eventually some degree of insulin deficiency. But you have lots of wiggle room in type 2 diabetes. You can get people under control just with diet if it's early enough. You can get people under control with pills. We now have 12 different medications to use for type 2 diabetes. And then you can resort to insulin in later stages when the medications don't work. But there's a lot more flexibility in managing patients with type 2 diabetes.
And gestational diabetes, the reason I love these shows is it might be that we're talking too specifically about medical terms and people have not gone to medical school and some of these words might go in one ear and out the other. But just in terms of, as Reverend Perry and Reverend Morrison have mentioned, information is so important. So gestational diabetes,
So gestational diabetes is basically diabetes that occurs in a woman who is pregnant that did not have diabetes before. Mm. And I like to think of it as if you take what I just described, you know, that 10-year process, 10 or 15-year process from going to normal to pre-diabetes, to diabetes because of worsening insulin resistance. If you can squeeze that into 9 months, that's what happens in gestational diabetes, is that typically these are women who have type 2 diabetes in the family because there's a strong genetic component to diabetes. And it's typically women who are overweight, not necessarily obese, but overweight. And they have insulin resistance. And when they have the baby inside, the placenta produces many hormones that worsen insulin resistance. It's complicated why that occurs, but just having the baby inside increases insulin resistance. And in those women that can't compensate with more and more insulin production, again, squeezed into 9 months, they develop high blood glucose, and we call that gestational diabetes. So it's very similar to type 2 diabetes, just occurring in younger women who are pregnant.
And Reverend Morrison and Reverend Perry, bear with me for a second. I guess I want to ask a follow-up, Dr. Nzuki, about the gestational. So if I'm a pregnant woman in my 30s, how do I know, what kind of tests can I take to kind of determine my susceptibility, if you will?
Is that for me?
Yes.
Oh, so I think that there's we call it GDM, gestational diabetes mellitus, GDM screening that occurs typically in the second trimester. And that is now recommended in everyone. Even when I was training, it was not given to really thin women. But now the American Academy of OBGYN recommends that there's routine screening of all women who are pregnant in their second trimester. And that's a glucose tolerance test where they drink glucose and they measure the blood glucose. And there are certain criteria as to whether they're headed to gestational diabetes. However, if a woman has risk factors, in other words, let's say she is overweight or there's a strong family history of diabetes, or she may have had gestational diabetes during an earlier pregnancy, well, that we would consider that woman high risk, and we wouldn't wait for the second trimester. We'd screen them right as soon as they find out they're pregnant with certain testing to see if they're headed for gestational diabetes.
Just so much information to digest. Is it fair to ask Reverend Perry and Reverend Morrison? I'll come to you in a second. But is it fair to ask Dr. Nzuki? And you might have alluded to this by nuance, but I guess wanted to kind of drive the point home. If we have any clear evidence of what causes type 1 and type 2 in diabetes. Is that a fair question to ask?
Yeah, if you're asking me, who you're asking the question to,
Dr. Nzuki, I'd like to get his medical opinion first. Is it fair to ask the
What causes? Yeah, that's a great question. And if you figure it out, you'll get a Nobel Prize.
So let's work on it. And some money comes along with the prize. And sometimes you give the Nobel Prize to a few people. So this could be the four of us to kind of help with that collection plate at the end.
The answer is really in the biology that I described. So it is insulin resistance that starts the process in motion. So the question now is, why do people develop insulin resistance? And one of the major contributors to insulin resistance is body weight. So as your body mass index, the BMI, which is basically your weight for your height, as your BMI increases, you get more insulin resistant. Unfortunately, as we age, sorry to say, we all get a little bit insulin resistant. Now, some of that may be because we're less active. But some of that may be built into the biology of aging as well. And there is a very strong genetic component to insulin resistance. So if you take people who are not overweight, but they have a family history of type 2 diabetes, and these studies were done by my colleague here at Yale, Jerry Shulman, in the 1990s, that if you test these individuals for insulin resistance, guess what? Even before they get overweight, they have insulin resistance. So there's a genetic component, and I think that's really important when we're talking about diabetes in minority communities. It's higher in Black and brown individuals in our society. That's a very complicated statement. I mean, there are nutritional issues, access to medical care, but also there's a strong genetic component. We see that in other parts of the world as well. For instance, in India, diabetes is a huge problem, even though if you look at the average body build of somebody in India, they're actually not necessarily overweight. They're certainly not obese. So there are genetic factors that predict and weight factors that predict who gets insulin resistance. And then the magic question, the one that will really get you the Nobel Prize, is why do some people have insulin resistance and are able to produce more and more insulin for their whole lives? They're able to sustain those high insulin levels to keep the glucose levels down. And there are some people that their pancreas just falls to pieces. They just can't keep making that insulin. That's the real question, is what is not necessarily what leads to insulin resistance, but what leads to the insulin deficiency that predicts who develops hyperglycemia.
And let's dig in just a little more, because I'm just really enthralled. I feel like I'm somewhat at a grand round, but again, the grand rounds are very informative. So, doctor, in terms of symptoms, if someone's listening, listen to the audio version or see the Facebook Live page, are there any symptoms of type 1 and type 2 in gestational?
Gestational, usually not. Because that is because we're picking that up early in the second trimester before it becomes full-fledged in the third trimester. Type 1 diabetes, it happens so suddenly that patients, individuals can go from feeling totally fine to feeling terrible over the course of several days. But the cardinal symptoms of diabetes would be increased urination, increased thirst, because if the blood sugar gets high, particularly if it gets into the 200, 300, 400s, there is, you urinate out the glucose. The body tries to get rid of the glucose, and that brings water with it. So you lose, you get dehydrated, and you're thirsty. Blurred vision, because the changes in glucose can change the shape of the lens in your eye, so you get blurred vision. Fatigue, obviously, because you're not being able to utilize to burn the glucose, the blood sugar for energy. So those are the main ones: increased urination, increased thirst, fatigue, blurred vision. But the important point is that's at late stages. You know, your blood sugar is already well into the 200s when that occurs. We need to diagnose diabetes at a very early stage. Once you're over 126, actually, I'd like to diagnose this in pre-diabetes so you never get to diabetes. Trust me, it's much easier to treat pre-diabetes than it is diabetes. Because once you're into diabetes, then there's complicated medications, sometimes insulin that's required. And I would love for people not to develop diabetes and just work on their healthy lifestyle and stay in that pre-diabetes category.
Excellent. No need to graduate to that downslope team, stay on the healthy team.
Right.
Reverend Perry and Reverend Morrison, I mean, you guys have been, and forgive my informality, but because I know you and the combined years that both of you have been involved in the vineyard of the health and people's spiritual health, body health, physical health, just community health, that those combined years would be roughly about 40 or 45 years for you, Reverend Perry, and 35 for Reverend Morrison. So when I talk about you being leaders of the African-American community in various communities in Waterbury and Brantford and New Haven, Reverend Morrison, where did you pastor before you came to New Haven?
In South Carolina.
South Carolina, not by Georgia. But what are some of your concerns when it comes to this impact of diabetes of those you serve and those you have served? Reverend Morrison, let me start with you.
Yeah. Tom, I, as Dr. Nzuki was speaking, especially kind of talking to, I guess, the causes of diabetes and what might win a Nobel Peace Prize, I was, you know, really thinking and almost in my mind grieving, because I think so much of the issues in our communities could be prevented if we had access to quality health care. And it's not that people don't want to be healthy and live healthy lifestyles, it's they can't afford it or they don't have knowledge of it. And a lot, you know, just prenatal screening and all of those things. But I think about the number of mothers and families that I've had to deal with in ministry who either said they didn't know they were pregnant or did not have access to prenatal care. And this is, you know, over the last 20 some odd years. So it's not, you know, years ago, it's now. I think about diabetes and how it is, it affects us culturally. In growing up, I just heard it was sugar. It had sugar. So it was almost done in a positive way, or at least it was some type of positive connotation to it. It was just you had a touch of sugar. And even in the movies, Soul Food was one of the movies I thought about. It was the grandmother who tried to cover it up and continued to eat the diet and things that we've normally had. The church is the backbone of our communities, and the church has sort of helped in this, but also hurt in this, because we kind of make it okay to eat these rich foods because we do this and we celebrate it in the church quite often. So I think we've got to be intentional. And I know Reverend Perry and I have been both personally, but also in our churches preaching and by example of healthy lifestyles and eating healthy and taking time to take care of your health. And so I think those are things that we have to continue to do. And I just was thinking about this as Dr. Nzuki was talking.
Mm-hmm. Reverend Perry?
I agree with Reverend Morrison in so many ways, how we undermine within our community some of the health challenges that are there. I pastored in Harlem for 25 years, and people were more concerned about gangs, drugs, and violence than they were about issues of health and you know, eating correctly or going to the doctor. You only went to the doctor if you were shot. You'd go to Harlem Hospital, or if you had some other thing, you'd go to Columbia Presbyterian. They knew where to take you. The EMS drivers knew where to take you depending on what you went there for. But I'm also looking at the fact that 20 years ago, when I was living as a child in Waterbury, an average Coca-Cola bottle was like 8 ounces, and it was in a glass bottle. Then they started supersizing, and then became 12 and 16 and 20. And, you know, the amount of intake of sugar has increased almost in everything we do. And so we had this discussion when we were talking in Yale about diabetes, and they were telling us how people were trying to go to sweet and low and less, you know, these artificial sweeteners. And the people who were with us, I think Bob Sherwin and some others, Kevin, said that's the artificial sweeteners are just as bad as the ones when you're pouring the sugar in. So it really has to come to, you know, a better healthy choice. And I think everybody's responsible. I mean, the people who make these sodas and these cookies, and I mean, we're all culpable and we all must pay the price for what happens to us as a culture. I'm definitely interested in the genetics of this because that's a new field. And I'm not sure in terms of research where we are with that and if there are some clues at the beginning of the page that we can start to apply early, maybe to new parents, to families that are younger, and start a process now where we can change the curve and the outcomes later. And that's why I think it's so important that education is so important. But being able to reach people, you know, if the pandemic taught us nothing, it taught us that minority people are underrepresented when it comes to healthcare and to health equity. And so somehow we've got to find a way of breaking through that barrier if we're going to make a difference.
Mm. You know, a lot of this is education. You know, a lot of this is education and just understanding how food gets converted into glucose and what happens in the couple hours after you eat and how medications for diabetes work and how the impact of healthy lifestyle, exercise, and also maintaining a healthy body weight. You know, these are just... They're simple messages, but I think sometimes we overlook that because we're all interested in medical therapies and the latest and greatest, gene therapy. But particularly in the transition from pre-diabetes for diabetes, the most important intervention is diet and exercise. And as I mentioned before, it doesn't have to be extreme. This is not marathon training or losing, you know, having bariatric surgery and losing 100 pounds. It's modest changes that even if you're very overweight, just losing 5-10 pounds can have a benefit in terms of blood glucose. And the other point I wanted to make in listening to the reverend today is the very simple description that I gave before about type 1 and type 2 diabetes, skinny and young and overweight and older, is starting to fall apart. Because number one, people are now figuring out that older folks, people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, can actually get type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. They used to be labeled as type 2 diabetes, but that immune destruction of the pancreas can actually occur at later ages. Not as commonly, but certainly not as frequent as occurs in younger folks. But even more important is that we're starting to see, tragically, type 2 diabetes, which used to be an old person's disease, in children and teens. Mm. This is a dramatic transformation in the epidemiology of diabetes. I'm not a pediatrician, but if you talk to my pediatric diabetes colleagues, they say that in the 1980s and 90s, their clinics only had type 1 diabetes, skinny kids with diabetes. And nowadays, it's actually more common for them to treat children with type 2 diabetes. Mm. And this is related to what you talked about in terms of access to quality education about lifestyle, quality food. You know, we talk about food deserts in underserved communities, the processed food, high sugar. I mean, the best thing we can do is to stop drinking soda, particularly the sugared sodas, and you know, switch to club soda and something with zero calories in it. We can do an enormous benefit to all communities by decreasing sugared beverage intake. And so we call it a low-hanging fruit that people realize that you know, they look at a bottle of Coca-Cola or 7-Up and say, how can I gain weight from that? There's no fat in that. Well, listen, there's a lot of empty calories in that. And I've seen patients really lose tremendous amount of weights by making that simple intervention of stop drinking sugared beverages. Mm. If you do that, there are some patients that I've seen that are having 3 or 4 cans of soda per day. And if you do the math, you know, that's 150 calories times 4, that's 600 calories a day. And there's, you know, 3,500 calories to the pound. So every 6 days, let's say round it off to a week, every week that they're drinking 4 cans of soda a day is a pound. And over the course of a year, that's 52 pounds. If you stop doing that, you can lose 52 pounds in a year. You know, these are they may sound complex, but they're actually very, very simple.
We have about 11 or so minutes, so time flies when we're really sharing and communing. But Dr. Nzuki, it seems to me you planted the seed about take us to research and new developments and just kind of lift us up a little bit with some possible where things are going to make life a little easier for folks.
Well, my research has been focused on optimal medical therapy for type 2 diabetes. In other words, matching the right pill to the right patient. And I think that in the past, we didn't have a lot of options. So we had insulin and we had a couple of pills that we use for diabetes. They all had side effects. Patients would gain weight. They developed the opposite condition, which was hypoglycemia, which is even worse than high blood sugar because you can actually pass out and even develop a coma if your blood sugar is too low. During my career, I've seen the enormous advances in new therapies for diabetes that actually have additional benefits of either not leading to hypoglycemia. In other words, they stop working once the blood sugar is normal. That's terrific. And also drugs that make you lose weight. They control your blood sugar and reduce your appetite and make you lose weight. And then over the past 5 or 6 years, we've been focused on one of the major complications of diabetes. All people know that diabetes can lead to vision loss, even blindness. It can lead to kidney failure and the need for dialysis. And it can lead to nerve damage, something we call neuropathy, that can lead to the need for amputations and sores on the feet. But what a lot of people don't know is that it's the major cause of heart disease, especially in the Black community, because hypertension is so rampant. So heart disease, heart attacks, strokes, heart failure, sudden death are all increased 2 to 3-fold in people with diabetes. And what we've looked at recently, this is just almost hot off the presses, but just in the past few years, we're now discovering that certain medications that we use for diabetes actually have a side benefit of reducing heart disease, reducing heart failure, and reducing stroke. So getting this message out that these newer therapies, unfortunately, they're all branded products and unfortunately very expensive. But actually in Connecticut, most of the insurances, including Medicaid insurance, actually do a pretty good job in covering these medications that you can actually not only control your blood glucose, but reduce your risk for heart disease as well.
Reverend Perry and Reverend Morrison, we have about 10 more minutes. Just in terms of what Dr. Nzuki just referenced, I wonder if we had any responses about the upcoming. Please.
Yeah, I am. I heard you say, Dr. Nzuki, before that there were 12 medications that you could take before you get to insulin, which is so very important. I was just thinking about the fact that. And I think Dr. Perry and I have discussed this before, is that as ministers, a lot of folk in our congregation will come to us before they go to their doctors or before they go to other persons in the community. And I'm just thinking the last, 21, 22 years of pastoring, I don't think I've ever had a member who I've said, you need to go to your doctor or I'm going to make sure you get there, who hasn't gone there. So the minister is a trusted voice in our community, and the more knowledge that our churches have, the better we're able and capable of speaking to and really kind of turning the tide of this thing. I'm thinking about the amputees, the persons who are on dialysis in our congregations. I've had just in the last year 4 people receive kidneys who are on dialysis in our congregation, and 2 or 3 more that are waiting on it. So this illness leads to others, and it's a ripple tide.
Yeah, and the important message I think is that some patients are reluctant to go to the doctor because they may recall a family member, maybe a grandmother, who had some terrible complication from the diabetes, and nobody wants insulin. I mean, I understand that. Nobody wants insulin. There's a stigma still attached to insulin therapy. Yeah. But I think the really important message is that I use much less insulin than I used to 10 years ago in my patients because of all these other medications. We're actually taking people off of insulin because of these new therapies. There's some new research studies that show new therapies for diabetes can lead to an average loss of 27 pounds. Mm. Never seen medications that can do that before. That's the average. So there are people that can lose 30, 40, or even more pounds with these new therapeutics. So that's the important message, is that we now have friendlier medications. It's not, you know, four injections of insulin per day. They're pills. Sometimes they're injectables, but they may be given once a week. Most people can do an injection once a week. It hurts less than just doing a finger stick. So I think that's the important message, that we've made lots of progress just in the past 5 or 6 years with new therapies that have side benefits on heart disease and losing weight as well. So that's an important message for everyone.
Okay, Zuke, you have a very quick question. There are a lot of people who go on to Amazon and all these sites looking for supplements, stuff like berberine. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it seemingly does have some benefits. Do you have any comments about that?
Yeah, I've seen the patients really benefit from lots of nutraceuticals, you know, cinnamon, vanadium, berberine, as you've mentioned. The problem is that they're not well studied. And when they are studied, the benefits seem to be, you know, kind of modest. That's a problem, right? Because we know that prescription medications, we know what they do. We know their warts in terms of side effects. We know their benefits because the FDA mandates these large studies involving sometimes tens of thousands of people. So we're pretty certain that medication, there's always surprises. There's some mistakes made in drug development, but we know what the medications can do and what they can't do. With these nutraceuticals, some, and I have a healthy respect for what I don't know, but you know, we just don't know how safe or how effective medications are, because the studies are not sponsored by, you know, large drug companies, right? Because there's not a lot of profit in them. So we don't have 10,000 patient studies. We may have 30 patients studied for 6 weeks, and you see a benefit, you're not sure if it's going to be long lasting. But you know, I think I would talk to your doctor about things that you want to start, and just be very careful, because there's a lot of charlatans out there, particularly on the web, in terms of trying to sell things that are potentially not only not effective and therefore risky because they cost money, but also may not necessarily be safe. But yes, I agree that traditional medicine doesn't do a good job in focusing on some of these nutraceuticals, which may have some benefit.
Gentlemen, we have about 5 minutes, so let's any closing thoughts or ideas or just prayers or even just suggestions. In terms of clinical trials, Dr. Nzuki, are you involved with some currently, or are you still, if someone wants to be involved, is that a possibility?
Yeah, most of my work has been in heart disease and diabetes, and we're working on some newer formulations of diabetes therapies that have additional benefits both on the heart as well as on the kidney. We're also focused on the management of diabetes in the hospital, which is always a great challenge. I'm sure that you have stories of friends or family members that were admitted to the hospital and the diabetes was not well managed because patients, sometimes when they're sick, their blood glucose goes higher than usual. So that's been a focus area of mine. And I have colleagues here in my section that are studying newer therapies for diabetes, newer therapies for obesity. Professor Kevin Harold, and I think it was Reverend Morrison may have mentioned, or Reverend Perry, that had actually been on the hot pursuit of prevention of type 1 diabetes. So he's a type 1 diabetes specialist, and he actually had a major paper, major discovery, the New England Journal of Medicine about a year and a half ago, showing that if you take individuals that are predisposed to type 1 diabetes, this is the immune form of diabetes, and you give them an immune therapy, you can actually prevent the development of diabetes. Very, very exciting work. So lots of interesting things going on at Yale in metabolism and diabetes.
Are you still seeking people to participate in the trials?
Yes, particularly for obesity trials and some of the type 1 diabetes trials, people with family histories of type 1 diabetes.
And so the best way for them to kind of throw their hat in the ring and to join in this cat.
Well, the Yale.edu website, you'll see links to the YCCI, which is the Yale Center for Clinical Investigation. And through that website, you can navigate to the proper trial that you might be eligible for.
And perhaps Reverend Perry and Reverend Morrison, you might want to talk about the need and the importance of the clinical trials being fair and for justice in the trials, meaning having people participate from all demographics and lifestyles. Any comments in that regard about that urgency?
I was just going to say that recently I've been appointed presiding elder over a district, our news district in South Korea, and discovering that even there, diabetes is an issue. And I'm dealing with largely Liberian persons who've been refugeed in South Korea. So in people of color, this is an issue. And so I would encourage everybody to enroll in these trials, especially Black and brown people all over the globe, any descent, to really participate in these trials.
Reverend Perry, we have about 30 seconds.
Now, I was simply say that I had a number of patients who lost limbs, toes, legs, and I think it's disproportionate because I think that they have not had the access to the medical community that probably could have prevented some of that loss of limbs.
Agree.
Dr. Nucci, I'll give you the last word. Harry will play the music. So what I do for the show is I maximize all the time I have, and he plays the music, and we're kicked off. But until we hear those the melodious tone of my my song of the show, I want to give you the last word and really thank you for being a part of this.
So for me, it's prevention is key. You know, I treat diabetes, but I don't want to treat more diabetes. I'd rather people stay normal or in the pre-diabetes, which is a healthier physiology, and keep moving, reduce sugared intake, lose 7% of your body weight, and you will prevent type 2 diabetes.
Okay. So that means that do not eat Reverend Perry's food then if you
don't want to die. Or drink the church punch. Don't do that.
Or drink the church punch. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Thank you.
As I got another rhyme, another rhythm for y'all to listen. I'm never quitting on my mission. I'ma roll with what I'm giving. Got some ambition, this new addition, filling positions. Looking at the void in myself and feeling what's missing. Better watch
this is Harry Groves, and you're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM.
Keep on working, open curtains, haters swerving, cause they ain't ready for your final version. I'm never gonna give up. Fall down, I just gotta get up, yeah. Cause this is my road. Lights, camera, action, I'm ready to go. I'm never gonna give up. Fall down, I just